Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and in this podcast, I talk to various people about the five things from their life that they would like to put in a time capsule. Simple. Now, they pick four things that they cherish and would like to preserve, and one that they would like to bury and never have to think about again. My guest this week is Rebecca Front. You'll know Rebecca from The Day to Day, The Thick of It, Alan Partridge, Nighty Night, Humans, The Aeronauts, and most recently, Avenue 5 with Hugh Laurie. And of course, from hundreds of other television, film, and radio appearances. I spoke to Rebecca at her home. In fact, in her bedroom. Well, she had the plumbers in. That's not a euphemism. I started by talking to Rebecca about her career.
Your career is going brilliantly at the moment, isn't it?
Well, you know, you're talking to an actor here, Mike, so yeah. Obviously, as far as I'm concerned, I'm never going to work again, and it's all a disaster, and everybody else is doing better than me. So, yeah, I mean, you know what it's like.
Yes, I don't think
I've ever reached a point in my career when I thought, oh, it's all going swimmingly. Yeah. I do remember talking to an actress a while ago. I was having lunch with this friend, and she's a bit younger than me, and she said something like, oh, you know, I cannot wait to get to the point that you're at, you know, where it's all just plain sailing. And I nearly spat my food.
You just slapped her.
Do you seriously think that's a thing? Because
no,
I don't know any actor who thinks that,
no,
ever.
You never get there. Even people you think are really huge stars have that dilemma, don't they?
Mm. Absolutely. I remember my brother talking about, he went to a talk by, I think it was Dustin Hoffman, and he said that one of the reasons he directed a film a few years ago was because he felt like, you know, his acting career was on the way and it wasn't working out too well. And I mean, you know, what hope is there for the rest of us?
Oh, really? No. Excuse me, I'm just going to go and slash my wrist.
Anyway, there you go. Yeah, so, but no, it's all going very nicely. Thank you very much for mentioning it.
I haven't seen the thing that's on Sky.
The mad sci-fi
Amanda
show, Avenue
show.
5. I think, I can say this because I'm only obviously in bits of it, I think it's extremely funny and extremely clever. I love Armando's work, and we've both worked with him, obviously.
Yes.
And I think...
Although we did do the one thing that the BBC rejected.
Well, this, yeah. Yeah, I know, but, you know, let's not take that personally. But anyway, yeah, Avenue 5, it's... I think it's going to take a little while for people to get it, because it's not Veep, it's not Thick of It, it's not politicians in an office swearing at each other. But it's also not Star Trek in that, you know, you're up in space, but there are no aliens or anything. It's just sort of venal people,
yes,
on a cruise
with
horrible leisure wear stuck together. And then they have no idea how long they're going to be there. And they all hate each other. And I think it's brilliant. It's incredibly funny and clever. And it's very, very Armando. And it's also, of course, a different kind of satire, because it's actually... it's a satire on society, yes, and on how people sort of metaphorically consume each other, you know, that people will just destroy each other if they clamber over each other in order to get a better deal. So it's very, very satirical, but I have a feeling it will just take people a while to kind of think, oh, okay, it's that then. So it is Armando, and I'm used to that sort of stuff, but it's just in a very, very different environment.
And then I can show it to my mother-in-law, who's just booked a cruise for the first time in her life,
really,
at the age of 83.
I mean, I think there are many things that would put me off going on a cruise.
Yes.
Avenue 5 is definitely one of them.
Yes. And maybe the entertainment.
And possibly the entertainment. I don't know. I just would drive. I mean, we've done overnight cross-channel ferries, and I can't wait to get off one of those at the end of it. So it's really not for me at all.
So we've got this time capsule.
Yes.
For you. It's nicely cleaned. I gave it a dusting.
Lovely. Very good. Okay. Well, I've gone for, slightly uncharacteristically for me, actually, I've gone quite personal with it.
Oh?
And I've gone for...
I'll stop the recording now.
Yeah. We're up in my bedroom. And now I'm telling you we're going to go personal. I was trying to think about what you meant about... As I always do with you, Mike, any communication with you, I just afterwards I think, what was he talking about? So I was trying to think what it was that you had in mind. And then I kind of started thinking about snapshot memories. And you know how sometimes a memory just pops into your head from,
yes,
absolutely nowhere. And it's really clear and really detailed. And
yes,
I thought maybe those were the things that would be in my time capsule, these slightly random little snapshots that you can describe quite clearly, like you can when you find an old photo and you look at it and everything makes sense and you remember where you got the jumper from and how long you'd had it and, you know, that you'd had just had an argument with your, you know, sibling or something. Those kind of memories where it's suddenly very, very clear. And once I started thinking about that, four or five of them quite quickly popped into my head.
Perfect.
So I thought they would be things to put in the time capsule.
Yes, no, I think that's absolutely right.
So should we go through chronologically?
Chronologically would work, wouldn't it?
So chronologically, then the first one is a childhood one. And I was really surprised, actually, that this one popped into my head because I grew up in a Jewish household and we never really thought of ourselves as particularly religious, although I think with hindsight we did a lot of Jewish stuff. We lit candles on Friday nights and we ate kosher food and things. So I think we were actually probably what people would think of as religious, but we didn't go to synagogue very often. I didn't think of us as a practicing family. I mean, to this day, if you show me a page of Hebrew, I could probably pick out maybe three words of it. You know, I can stumble through the odd letter, but so I'm not a sort of, you know, particularly religious Jewish person at all. But one of the first snapshots that popped into my head was of being in synagogue with my family. And I think it was more about the family than the being in synagogue bit. We didn't go regularly, but we would always go once or twice a year for the big festivals. And in a very typically Jewish fashion, the biggest of big festivals is the most depressing one, which is Yom Kippur, where you'd starve yourself for 25 hours and don't drink anything and just sit in synagogue for as long as you can tolerate. Everybody's miserable. Everybody has halitosis and it's all quite grim. But oddly, I quite enjoy it. So we would go every year for Yom Kippur and we'd go for Rosh Hashanah, which is the new year which precedes Yom Kippur. And we'd usually go for two mornings of Rosh Hashanah. And a morning service, by Jewish standards, is relatively concise in that it's a mere 4 hours long,
whereas
Yom Kippur
whizzes by,
rattles along at 17 or something. So, but in the year running up to my brother's bar mitzvah, we went more regularly. We were going probably most Saturdays because my brother would have to be up to speed with his Hebrew and so on. Mm. So we just did. And oddly, I quite liked it, I think. I mean, I obviously didn't like it enough to carry on going. I mean, now I'm back to going to shul twice a year again. But I think as a kid, I was predisposed to being slightly holier than thou anyway. And I quite liked the whole drama of it. I liked the sort of, you know, everybody dressed up smartly and the formality of it, going and sitting in rows, and a great deal of time is spent standing up and intoning and being quite serious and somber, and then quite a lot of time is spent sitting down with my dad whispering naughty jokes and trying to make everybody laugh because he's got
So you were acting a role.
Yeah, I think maybe that's why I liked it. Yeah, because it was the public face of the front family.
Yes.
Maybe that is what I liked. And then there'd be other things like The men would always wear prayer shawls. They'd wear these long, so they'd obviously wear yarmulkes, the little skull caps, but they'd also wear these prayer shawls, which have a bit of embroidery on them, and then they have a fringe at the bottom, a sort of silk fringe. When I was younger, I just used to, when I got bored in service, I would sit and plait the fringes at the end of my dad's prayer shawl, and Dad would find, thought this was very sweet, you know. Yeah. So he'd be sitting there, kind of, you know, going, in Hebrew, and I'd be just kind of tying knots and then doing like cornrows at the end of the thing. So that's sort of the snapshot that popped into my head for the time capsule, is sitting in a row with my family, and everybody's slightly dressed up, and my mum wishing she hadn't worn high heels, yeah, and me plaiting the fringes.
I was brought up Catholic, but I think I probably went through the same experience as you, which is that I would go to Mass before I went to school in the morning.
Wow,
at the convent.
Really?
Yes.
Every morning?
When I was between about the age of 13 and 15, till I discovered girls.
Right.
And then, well, I discovered them, but I couldn't get near them.
Right.
But I would go to Mass in the morning and sit right at the front in my school uniform, very cleanly pruned and primmed up and everything.
Yeah.
And I could feel the eyes of the nuns on my back.
Really?
So for me, it was
judging
all...
Judging you?
No, it was a performance.
Oh,
I could
right.
feel the admiration. Oh, this beautiful little boy has come here, and he's sitting there, and he's saying everything so clearly and so
That's
well.
That's so brilliant.
And so, yeah,
yes,
that whole thing of doing a performance in church.
Performative holiness.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not feeling holy at all.
Really. I think one of my associations with going to synagogue, even now, actually, is because I, like you, I love singing. And there's a lot of singing in Judaism. And I could actually manage to keep up with the songs, because when you're following the Hebrew in a song, it moves slower,
yes,
than if you're trying to read it in a prayer, when people tend to rattle through it, and I can't do that. So I could join in with the songs, and I could do harmonies and things. And I do remember kind of thinking, I'm not sure how much this is holy and how much is actually just me showing that I can do harmonies.
Yeah.
And then thinking, well, if I believe in God, then maybe it was God who taught me to do the harmonies, so that's okay then.
You're paying
I'll
him back.
Do them even louder now. Show off even more.
And I'll spend longer doing my hair.
Yes, yeah, I'm putting my posh clothes on.
Oh,
but yeah, there is, I mean, of course, there is an element, and I think there always was in group religion, of people wearing their Sunday best,
yes,
and people showing the best, their best face. And there's that wonderful thing, isn't there, in Father Ted, the couple in that dreadfully sort of abusive marriage,
yeah,
who stop hitting each other the minute the priest walks in. Ah, Father! Oh, it's so good to see you, Father. And I love that side of it, you know, that we all know that actually what we present in church or in synagogue or whatever is in no way reflective of the way we actually live our lives.
No, no. In a Catholic Mass every Sunday, the church would empty of men immediately after communion.
Mm.
So once they'd actually got the bread and they'd had eaten the body of Christ and therefore been blessed, that was good enough for them.
And
in fact, they quite often would have a little slight taste of sherry at that point, and that would immediately make them rush to the pub.
Right.
So all the men would go, and they would go straight to the pub, and
right,
then the women would come out afterwards and hang around the priest like Beatles fans.
Yeah. Yeah, that all sounds very familiar. I think ultimately it's all the same the world over.
Yes. Oh, that's lovely. So let's take that. That's a gorgeous moment.
Lovely.
So you can sit with your mum and dad and your brother.
Plaiting the fringes on.
Plaiting fringes.
That's
right.
Special.
So what's your second item?
My second one. Okay, this would be quite different, but it's one that you will definitely associate with. We talked a minute ago about singing, and I've done a couple of musicals, not a huge number, but I've always loved musical theatre and always sort of dreamt of being in a musical. And then some years ago, and this was, oh gosh, probably about 25, 30 years ago, something like that, I had the opportunity to meet Sam Mendes after a recording of something. I'd done a TV show and Sam was there, and I introduced myself to him afterwards. And in a slightly kind of post-show, I've just downed a glass of wine and I'm feeling a bit sort of silly moment. I just kind of went, oh, I love everything you've done and I just love to be in something of yours. And I think at the time he had Oliver on in the West End.
Yes.
I think that's what I was angling.
He was already a huge director.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And his only, he's, what, my age, a year older than me or something.
Yes.
At that stage, he'd made it big very, very quickly.
Mm.
And he, of course, knew who I was because he'd just seen me in this recording, so
yes,
he knew that I could do comedy and so on. So we have this brief chat and he said, oh, yeah, well, I know your work and it'd be great to work with you. And I said, and I sing as well. And he said, great. Well, we're doing a Christmas show at the Donmar. Maybe come and audition. So the next morning I rang my agent and said, I spoke to Sam Mendes and he said I should come and audition. And he followed through on it. So the Donmar got in touch with my agent and they said, you know, does Rebecca want to come and audition? And I auditioned for a company, which was going to be the Christmas show, and got a part. And so suddenly there I was doing not just my first theatre show, my first professional theatre show, but working with Sam Mendes and in a musical, a Sondheim musical. And it was just like...
All my dreams come true.
And it ended up, in fact, we did, because we went to the West End as well, we ended up doing 9 months of it. So it's like a pregnancy. And it was just one of the best jobs ever. I mean, it really was a dream job. I met so many wonderful people, many of whom have remained friends for all these years, like Sophie Thompson and Clive Rowe, just people who I absolutely adore. So for Time Capsule purposes, I was trying to think about a career moment that wasn't to do with telly specifically, because I think that's probably, I'm slightly more known for doing telly stuff, and that's mainly what I've done.
Mm.
And I suddenly thought about the opening number of Company, which of course we did hundreds, thousands of times over the course of 9 months, which is anyway a brilliant piece of musical theatre. It's the most wonderful song. But the way it was staged at the Donmar, which is in the round, for people who haven't been there, so Sam had us kind of popping out of doorways unexpectedly and running around this walkway above the audience's heads and calling to each other across this gantry. And it was sort of very dynamic and very exciting. And it's a very exciting song and it has great harmonies. And we all had little solo moments in it and everything. And every night it would get this whoop at the end of it, because it's so energizing, and you come to the end of this number and there'd be a sort of momentary lull and then wow from the audience, because they're just thinking, this is going to be good. We've now got 2.5 hours of good show in front of us.
And that song is sort of almost a musical in itself, sort of the whole musical encapsulated.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It tells you everything you need to know really about Bobby and his the friendships that he has established, and you already, I think, start to see the cracks in those friendships, the sort of the fissures that are going to cause problems as the show goes on. But just an incredibly exciting thing to be a part of. And that would definitely be one of my time capsule moments, doing that show and that brief pause at the end of the number. And then the whoa from the audience every night. There's nothing like that. I mean, you know, because you've done musicals.
I have, but you don't often experience that.
Right.
I mean, you experience people, audiences enjoying shows.
Mm.
But to get that moment where they absolutely realise that this is probably going to be the most exciting night that they've been to for years.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing. I did do a musical of It's a Wonderful Life, written by Steve Brown.
Yes.
And that had exactly that thing at the end.
Mm. And my husband, Phil, brought the kids to see it. I think I was away.
Mm.
And he was talking about it recently and said how wonderful it was. Yeah.
But it had that extraordinary thing that where you become almost used to it, where we would finish and then there would be this pause and then the audience would erupt.
Yeah.
And stand up.
Yes.
And to get amazing. A standing ovation is amazing. Yeah. We got it so often. One night, there was one man in the front about 3 weeks into this run and he didn't stand. And the whole of us were so affronted by this. How could, and then very slowly, he grabbed two sticks and pushed himself up and then waved his sticks in the air. And we all burst into tears, of course, because it was so beautiful.
But yeah, we used to. I remember that same feeling that because we would get standing ovations most nights.
Mm.
I'm now being competitive with you, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
We got them every night. We'd be slightly affronted if somebody didn't. Yeah. And you'd always spot the person in the fourth row off to the left who wasn't standing, who was kind of going, "Eh, not for me." and the whole cast, and it was quite a big cast, would come off stage and go, "Did you see him?
Honestly, what a dreadful...
I mean, what could he possibly have done?
Disgusting jumper he was wearing.
But
that is exactly that feeling you were saying earlier about being an actor.
Mm.
And even though everything's going well, you think, oh, this is the last time I'm going to work.
Absolutely,
And so you notice the person who didn't quite love it.
Of course you do. It's terrible, isn't it? I don't think audiences notice that. I mean, I think they're not... You're not aware how brightly lit you are as an audience member, and that actually we can see you.
We
do know what you're thinking, and if you're not laughing, we know you're not laughing.
Yeah.
As an actor, when I now go to shows, I'm acutely aware that the people I know in the show, or even the people who might just know that I'm an actor, will know. In fact, yes. I remember I have an awful confession to make, which is I went to a show a couple of years ago. Friends got us tickets to see something at the Barbican. And I'm not a big drinker. I mean, I love a glass of wine or a cocktail or something, but usually it's like I'll have a drink and that's me done. And I, so you can hear the builders banging downstairs. I made the mistake before this show at the Barbican of having two dry martinis. I never have two dry martinis. So one dry martini, fine, then I would have, you know, sort of been relaxed and enjoyed the show. But two was a disaster because I didn't realise that Phil had booked us tickets in the second row back. Ooh. And I couldn't stay awake.
No.
Could not stay. And it was actually really good. I mean, it was a very good production. And it was that horrible thing where I thought, oh my God, I know that they've clocked that there are actors in.
You do, you always know. Notice them, yes.
And we were right near the front and I just couldn't, I was just going, head was dropping. And then it was horrible and I felt so awful. I felt like emailing afterwards to the stage management or something and saying, can I do it? And then I thought, no, that's so incredibly... Because A, they might not have noticed. Yeah. And B, that's...
I'm sorry, who is she?
It's like, it's all about
Rebecca
me.
Front. Rebecca, you've heard of Rebecca.
Rebecca who? No, I don't
know. I never watched you.
But
in.
Now I know that she didn't...
Has she done any theatre? Not so much.
I decided, wisely decided against it. But yeah, just felt awful. Because you know when you've been on stage, and I haven't done very much stage at all, but you know, you know that you know what's going on and you know when people are bored and you know when they're not getting the jokes.
Yeah.
So, yes, I still feel very guilty about that.
And it's a funny thing, isn't it? Because actors generally blame the audience in those situations.
Yeah.
And my wife is always tells me off if I ever do that.
Yeah.
Because she says, so just as a complete mass, they all decided not to like it.
Yeah.
Is that right? So it wouldn't be down to the fact that you're not as good as you were last night.
Yeah. I mean, this is... I think I tried to take that attitude when I was doing more theatre, that I would sort of try to think, well, actually, no, it surely... That doesn't make any sense for it to just be a bad audience.
No.
I think sometimes there are circumstantial things, like maybe the sound isn't quite as good one night, or maybe it's a bit cold in the theatre or a bit hot in the theatre.
Mm-hmm.
There are things like that which can affect a whole audience.
Yes.
But, yeah, I think by and large you have to think we're probably a bit slow tonight or we're just not quite... gelling. Or
you think you're doing the same thing, but you're just not. Maybe you're just doing it by numbers.
Yeah.
Which means that it's dead.
Yeah, absolutely. And people do pick up on that.
Mm.
But then it's also odd, and you'll have had this experience as well, when something goes, in your mind, catastrophically wrong, and absolutely nobody in the audience seems to notice. And that's quite weird. So there is a kind of group thing somehow, I think, that with audiences that... You just, I suppose, because you don't know the material as well.
No.
You do get swayed by people next to you loving it. And so there is a sort of snowballing effect.
Yes.
If there's a group in the front who aren't enjoying it, that will slightly affect the people behind them.
Because there's a barrier between them and the stage of nothing.
Yeah. And it's not
Or alternatively, you get somebody who over-enjoys it, who finds it overly funny.
Yes.
And you think, no, give it a chance. You know, you're laughing at everything uproariously.
Absolutely.
I've done panto with that. There were a family that we called them the Jollies.
Right.
And they would come every year and sit in the same seats and then laugh hysterically at everything. Everything. Hello. I just said hello. It's not funny yet.
So brilliant. And you can't ban them, can you?
No.
You're enjoying this too much, you bastards.
But they eventually stopped coming when the comic in the show just went, what is wrong with you people? You laugh at everything. I mean, it'd be great fun to be in your house, you said. Yeah, so, oh, look, the dog's dead. Ha, 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 ha. Hang on, I've got cancer. This is in a panto.
Oh, my God.
He just lost it.
Really?
Yeah. And they
never came
But in. They did laugh hysterically at him taking the mickey out of them.
Oh,
and so did the rest of the audience, because they realised that finally we were admitting that I know these people are a pain.
Oh, my goodness. We had... the reverse thing once, years ago, when I was in a double act with Sean Ed William. We used to do these sketch and musical shows, and in very, very small fringe venues, you know. And, of course, you really want people to laugh in that, you know. You really, really need to create an environment where people feel safe to laugh, because you're very exposed in a venue like that. And I remember inviting a friend of ours who we knew from university, who is a lovely guy, but he had a slightly odd sense of humour. And he took our work very seriously. He was quite a serious guy himself. And he was very much of the opinion that our sketch show was art. It was you know, a creative process, and people needed to be quite reverential towards it. It was very respectful to him. And I remember realising it was a terrible mistake to have got him a free ticket and sat him in the front row, because every time people laughed, he'd turn around and glare at them. Do you mind? They've spent ages crafting this.
There's a beautifully written joke.
And you've squashed it now because you laughed too soon. And it squashed the whole show flat. And we knew from about the beginning of the first sketch, we thought, oh, we're in trouble here.
Big mistake.
We're in terrible trouble. And people were kind of glaring and nudging each other.
Why did you marry him?
You know, I wanted to be taken seriously, Mike. What can I say?
Oh, fantastic. So we're going to take that beautiful, weighted silence,
yes,
before the explosion of the audience.
Yes.
And that's in there.
And but can we allow the explosion of the audience as well? Because otherwise it could just be a horrible silence.
We're going to then do one of those terrible BBC fades where it just disappears away. But you'll get the start of it.
Okay, that's all right.
So you can sit there and have that tension, that moment. Is it going to happen? Yes.
Yes, it's happened again. Yes, that's all I want. Basically, if you can just give me the applause, I'll take that in the time capsule. I'm quite happy with just a soundtrack of some applause.
Just going on and on and on. Oh, no, please, I can't bow anymore.
And occasional voices of people going, isn't she amazing? I'd be quite happy with that.
I'll put together a tape and send it to you.
Good, thank you.
Oh, fantastic. So, we move on to number three.
The third
item you would like to knock in this time capsule.
Yes, okay. Well, let's go quiet with it then. Let's go, because we've just been sitting in an audience, so we need to get out and get some fresh air. And we now have a dog, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And rarely an interview goes by when I don't mention this dog, because I'm obsessed with him. He's the love of my life. But anyway, the reason we now have a dog, because I was not a dog person at all. I'm not, you know, I didn't grow up with dogs. For years and years and years, I would just say I'm not a big fan. If anything, I'm slightly scared of them. They're a bit yappy. I don't quite get them. They jump at you. So I really wasn't a big fan. And what changed was that our friends, Martin and Sue, who live down in Somerset, we spend a lot of time with them.
Yeah.
They got a dog. And Sue, like me, was not a dog person. In fact, she used to be quite sneery about other people in Somerset who had their dog with them. You know, wherever, say, people would sort of turn up at the house and say, oh, can we bring the dog in? And Sue would think, oh, really?
Really?
And, so,
no, I'm with her.
So, I always was as well. And then when they got a dog, I kind of thought, oh, this is interesting. I wonder what's persuaded them. And she clearly had gone quite dewy-eyed very quickly about their dog, who was called Monty, and he was a lurcher. So we went down to visit, and I was sort of all ready to try and, you know, put on a polite face and be nice about Monty. But there was something about Monty that just completely beguiled me from the minute I first met him. He wasn't a pretty dog. He was sort of, you know, lurchers are, they're interesting and rather noble-looking, but they're not sort of warm and cuddly and cute looking.
No, they don't look as if they're smiling, do they?
No, they look like wolves, actually. They're sort of very, you know, very lupine. So he didn't, it wasn't like an instant kind of, oh, what a cute little thing. But there was something about him that I just thought, oh, I like you. I like the cut of your jib. You know, he felt like he understood stuff. He looked rather wise and sensible. And that was when he was a puppy. And then as we got to know him a bit more, he just became more and more like a sort of, like a wise Mr. Badger kind of character, and absolutely became a linchpin in our family. So we'd go to stay with these friends or to visit them three or four times a year.
Mm.
And as we got to know Monty a bit better, Martin and Sue would say, well, listen, if you want, you and the kids can take Monty out for a walk without us, you know, because we've got work to do or whatever. So sometimes Monty would come for walks with us. Sometimes we'd stay in a holiday cottage which was dog friendly, so that Monty could actually come and stay for a few nights. And Monty became our sort of surrogate dog. And as far as the kids were concerned, Tilly, like me, I think was a little bit nervous at the beginning and then grew to just absolutely love him. Ollie developed this bond with him where he genuinely would say, I think Monty is sort of my brother. He's my dog brother. He just had this absolute cast iron bond with Monty. They understood each other. There was a real sense of, you know, I don't believe in reincarnation, but if I did, Monty undoubtedly would have been connected to Ollie in some way. So anyway, Monty became a sort of massive part of our lives. And that's why ultimately we decided a few years ago, because the kids have been nagging and nagging, and we sort of thought, you know what, maybe we should get a dog, because maybe we need that in our lives. Maybe that would be a wonderful thing, to come home from work every day and have this creature who's just desperate to see you. And it has been. It's proved to be kind of life-changing. It's just a wonderful thing. Anyway, the sad part of all this is dear old Monty died last year. He was finally sort of sent packing because life had become fairly unbearable for him. But not before he'd changed not just their lives, but our lives. And it sort of goes deeper, I think, than just the fact that he made us want to have our own dog. I mean, he absolutely informed the kids' development into adults. So we would take him on these immensely long walks when both children were really far too young to be doing kind of 8-mile walks. But we'd do it because Monty was there, and because if Monty wanted to do it, then we'd do it.
Yeah.
So that would be my time capsule memory, I think, would be of one of these walks with the four of us, me, Phil, Ollie, Tilly and Monty. And the time capsule thing in particular that I'd want is there's a walk that we do just near where Martin and Sue live, where there's you sort of climb up a slope going through a wood. You sort of climb up this track higher and higher and higher. When you get to the top, you come out into a clearing, and there's quite a wide brook that is slightly too... There's a little sort of rickety bridge that goes across it, and I would always use the bridge because I'm very sensible, middle-aged. But Ollie, certainly when he was younger, would always leg it across this brook, because you could just about... If you took enough of a run-up, you could do it. And Monty, being a lurcher, would do this as if it was... It was like watching Nureyev. It was the most beautiful, balletic thing to just see him... running without any... There's no sense of him planning, you know, I need a bit of a run-up or anything. He'd run, and then he'd take off, and he'd be suspended for a second in mid-air, and then he'd just very gently land and glide off, and then Ollie would follow him. And that would be my snapshot, I think, is of Monty in mid-air and Ollie about to launch himself, and me on the rickety bridge going, Ollie, be careful! It would be that, moment. Because, of course, inevitably, there were one or two times when Ollie misjudged it and ended up, you know, with one leg completely submerged.
With only 4 miles to go.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely drenched and covered in mud.
Children do have an affinity with animals that we are reticent to allow to happen, I think, as adults. You become more guarded.
Yeah.
But children will just take them straight in. My children, their grandparents had my wife's parents had a dog called Sam, which was a golden retriever. It was a lovely dog, very gentle, and they do have that face that looks as if it's sort of slightly smirking all the time, you know, and slightly apologetic, and they put their head down and say, sorry, I didn't mean to bump into you. I remember that moment exactly with my children going for a walk, and they were too small, and my daughter was holding the lead, and the dog got to the point where it would normally be let off the lead and run into the field, and it was so excited that it ran, but she hadn't taken it off the lead, and it dragged her along the ground. And then, for days afterwards, Sam just followed her around and just sort of kept going up behind her and just putting his head right down and, in a way, almost subjugating himself to her
as
an apology.
Yeah.
And he just didn't forget it. And that's extraordinary, isn't it? He felt so guilty.
Oh,
my God, I didn't mean to do that. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. You could almost hear the voice in his head.
That's incredibly touching. It really is. Yeah. No, they are. I mean, I remember coming back from one of these walks with Monty. It was a fairly short walk until he was quite little at that time. And somewhere along the walk, she and Ollie had a little falling out about something really stupid, you know, like a...
Brothers and sisters.
Yeah, like a sweet or something. I don't know, you know, some really silly something and nothing, but she got quite bothered about it. And we went back and we took the dog back to Martin and Sue's, and we sat down for a cup of tea until she wasn't crying, but she was just a bit quiet because she'd had a bit of a falling out. And Monty just knew. And whereas he would normally tend to gravitate more towards Ollie, he just wouldn't leave her side.
No.
And kept sort of going and putting his chin on her lap. And it was incredibly touching. He just absolutely knew there's something not right here. Don't know what it is, but that one, the little one. With the curls, she's not right today, so I better look after her. Another thing that Monty used to do, which again all dogs do, I think, certainly our Bailey does it. When you're on a walk, if somebody's lagging behind, Monty would always try and round you all up. So he'd get to the top of a hill and then he'd run back and make sure that the next person and the next person and the next person would all get to the top.
Stay together.
Move forward until
there are lupines coming.
Yes, new lupine volpines.
Yes.
So he was very sort of protective that way. But when you've got small children or even sort of young teenagers who are just getting to that point where they're thinking, what is the point of this walk? What is the point of it? Why are you making me do this on a Sunday afternoon when I could be indoors watching telly? That's enchanting to have this animal,
yes,
this non-verbal creature going, I need you. I need you for me to enjoy this walk. I need you here now. So come on, I'm going to run back down this hill and get you and bring you up to the top of the hill with me. And it never failed. And now they still, I'm glad to say that, you know, they're 18 and 21, our kids, and they love nothing better than going on a walk. It's all, I think, as a result of Monty and this sheer unadulterated joy of being with him.
Imagine trying to persuade them to do that as teenagers with no dog.
Yeah.
It's not going to work, is
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely, that's right. Well, like, it would work with Tilly as she got older when we'd go shopping.
We're going to walk to the shops.
I'm coming, a big step count going shopping. In fact, I once wrote a piece for, I was asked to do a travel piece for a newspaper. And I said, oh, you know, I'd quite like to do a sort of walking holiday thing. And they said, yeah, that sounds good. And then I thought, I know what would be great. Because they were saying things like, do you want to go to Sydney? You know, do you want to...
Wow.
And I was thinking, no, I don't like flying very much. I'll do something a bit closer to home. And then I suddenly thought, I know what I'll do. I'll say we'll do a shopping walking holiday in Rome.
Ooh.
And they went for it. It was great. Ooh. So I took Tilly on a shopping walking tour of Rome. We didn't buy anything apart from lunch. Because we couldn't afford anything at all. Not on what they were paying me for the travel piece. But it was brilliant. We did about 7 miles walking every day for 3 days. But we walked around the Forum and we walked around the shops and we walked around, you know, just Rome. And it was really, really good fun.
It's great, isn't it, Rome, for that?
Yeah.
You can just walk around it.
Yeah.
Although I made the mistake of remembering from my teenage years that the Appian Way was accessible from the centre of Rome.
Right.
And I persuaded my wife that this was the case. And so we started walking. And 15 miles later,
yes,
we finally reached the cobbles.
Yes.
We've
had exactly the same experience with Seaned, my old double app partner. We did exactly the same thing years ago, Seaned and her husband and me and Phil. And Seaned was going, it's the Appian Way. It's the Appian Way. We've got to do it. And exactly that, after about 5 miles, we were all going, OK, we are so done with this. It's boiling hot. It's August.
Taxi.
There are no taxis.
No.
We're now just stuck on this path. There's nothing here. We might as well be on the North Circular.
And I absolutely remembered it as a young man. Seeing the Appian Way go off up into the hill,
happy children skipping about,
and you think it's a genuine Roman road. There are great slabs and it goes away just like you used to draw it with the slice through it at school.
Yes, yeah, that's right. The slice through it. I know exactly what
you mean. What I mean by that.
Yeah, I think I've still got those exercise books.
Oh my word. Oh, well, lovely Monty.
Lovely Monty.
I can picture him now.
He's a dream dog. We were terribly upset when dear old Monty left us last year. And we did really genuinely feel like we'd lost our dog, even though he was never ours. He was always Martin and Sue's. But he had a particular bond, I think, with our family because we'd spent so much time with him.
Mm. So. Well, we're going to put Monty leaping the brook.
Yes.
With Ollie jumping behind him and you being slightly pensive on the bridge.
Yeah,
that's it. That might be my next play. Pensive on the bridge.
Oh, yeah, I like that. Mm. Can I play pensive?
Yes. I'll be the bridge. In it goes, into the time capsule.
Excellent.
So that's three things we've had.
Very good. Rattling through them.
Before we go on to the next item, here's a quick advert. We'll be back in a minute.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, we're back. Let's find out the thing that Rebecca would really like to get rid of by burying it in the time capsule.
So, yes, negative snapshot for the time capsule. This is something, in fact, that I've written about and talked about quite widely, although for years and years I didn't talk about it at all. But I went through a phase when I was school phobic when I was 11. And it was it was not fun, turns out. Who knew? You would think that not going to school for long periods of time would be an absolute hoot, but actually it was very, very gloomy and not fun at all. And the background to it just sort of was that I grew up in an area where we still had grammar schools, so you still had to do the 11 plus exam, and you know, everybody wanted to get into these grammar schools. And I was lucky enough to get into one of the local grammar schools. There were two, and there was one that was a little bit further away from home, and that was the one it was a girls' grammar, and all the girls wanted to go there. It was considered a very, very prestigious school. And I got a place there, so that was brilliant. So then in the summer holiday running up to that, I was all excited about going, and I had my uniform and everything. We went off to Yorkshire for the summer holiday, and it was a very hot day, and we went for a picnic by the banks of a river, the River Wharf, I think it was. And my dad and my brother were paddling in the river, and my dad got his foot caught, he thinks, in the roots of a tree. And there was obviously a kind of whirlpool created by the root system of this tree. And he lost his balance trying to pull his foot out and almost drowned. I mean, it was by the time he was pulled out of the river, he was barely conscious. So it really was touch and go whether, you know, there was a moment when I think everybody on the riverbank thought he was dead.
Witnessed this.
And we saw it. My mum and I were sitting with the picnic stuff. And we could see my brother in the distance kind of waving at us. Well, they were both waving. And then we noticed it was just Jem waving. And then we realised he wasn't. And it really was like the Stevie Smith thing. He wasn't waving. Dad was drowning. So we got up and we just legged it and tried to run. I remember sort of glancing down and seeing there was blood pouring from my foot because I didn't have any shoes on, and we were just running across, you know, earth and rocks. And in the distance, we could see, they weren't far from us, but there was a bend in the river, so we had to kind of round this bend in order to get to them. And there were these snapshots of things going on while we were running. And I can remember somebody trying to go in, and then somebody else shouting, "I can't reach him," and my brother was trying to pull him out. And my brother, I think, was about 14 at the time, and just couldn't physically pull him out. It was horrendous. It was really awful. And then the two sort of miracles that happened were, as we rounded the bend and we were getting much closer to where Jem, my brother, was at this point, was on the riverbank, was just sort of hysterical. As we got there, I remember these three guys pulling off their T-shirts and just shouting something like, one of them said something like, "Booger this," because it was Yorkshire. And they ran in. They just waded in. And they obviously decided, right, we are not letting this happen.
No.
So they pulled him out, these three strong guys just hoiked my dad out and dumped him on the riverbank. And then, second miracle, a woman suddenly appeared and said, "I'm a nurse, let me get to him." And she turned him on his side and she whacked him and got water out of his lungs. And he just sat up and went, "All right, it's absolutely fine."
Oh, my word.
But it was absolutely traumatic.
How old were you, sorry?
I was 11. I was coming up to 11, that's right. So
word.
I was about to start, 2 weeks later I was due to start secondary school. So anyway, we stayed on holiday. For the next day, we were all in shock. And it was, you know, we discussed whether we should go home. And my dad said, no, I'm fine. And I think it would be better for us to be here. So we stayed and we had a nice day and we all tried to kind of calm down. And then the following day, we got a phone call saying my grandfather had died. So it was just these two, and I was very close to my grandfather, so it was these two horrible things that happened very close to each other. Then we drove back to London and had this horrible, you know, awful drive back. My mother, obviously, heartbroken. And, we drove back. Jewish funerals happened very soon after the death, so we had the funeral the following week and, you know, and the shiver, you know, where people come to the house every night. So it was all of this was happening, and then I had to start this new school, and I just couldn't do it. So I started school, and I think at the beginning seemed to be okay, but actually what had got into my head was that somehow this was all because I took my eye off the ball, and that it was because I wasn't, if I'd been there with Dad, he wouldn't have nearly drowned. And if I'd been at home in London with my grandfather, he wouldn't have died. It was all obviously because I wasn't keeping an eye on them. It's very sort of narcissistic 11-year-old thinking. So I decided that I couldn't go to school because if I walked away from my mum, if I got the bus to school, then something was going to happen to her. Obviously, you know, death was working his way through the family and clearly it was going to be her next. So I had to just be at home with mum. And actually, obviously, what was going on was that I was terrified and I was in shock and I really needed a bit of therapy. But back in those days, nobody really thought like that. So that was the background to it. And it reached a point where I was going to school sometimes, and then I was having what I now understand to be panic attacks and having to come home. And other days I couldn't go in at all. And then some days I'd go in and I'd be fine, actually, and I'd have a really nice day. And then the next day I couldn't do it. And it got worse and worse. And it reached a point where in the end I just left the school and was homeschooled for a while until I got a place at a different, at the other grammar school nearer to home, where there just happened to be, I mean, actually, to be fair, there were a couple of teachers at the original school who were trying to help, but they didn't really quite understand what was going on.
No.
Neither did I. But there happened to be a wonderful deputy head teacher at the new school who just sorted it, just took me under her wing and said, right, we're going to make this work. It's all going to be fine. And within about a week of starting at the new school, she got the whole thing under control. She knew how to handle me. She knew what was going through my mind, and she'd sorted it. And I was back in schooling and I never looked back after that.
No.
So the snapshot of that, the negative snapshot, I think, would be when I think back to that period, I think about being at the first school, the first grammar school, and what would happen was that I would, first of all, I'd try everything I could not to go to school at all in the mornings. I mean, literally, I'd be throwing my shoes out of the bedroom window and screaming and being sick and all these things that by rights should mean I didn't go to school.
That's
you can't
it.
Go
you
to school
go.
If you vomited. You can't go to school if you've got no shoes. So I'd be doing all that kind of stuff in a, you know, hysterical manner. This wasn't calculating. This was just me thinking, I can't do this. You can't make me do this. But sometimes, somehow, miraculously, my parents would get me to the school and they'd walk me in. And then I'd get sort of swept up in that thing of being around my friends, and that would be OK. But then there'd be a certain point every day when I'd suddenly think I can't do this. I just can't be here because I should be at home keeping an eye on my mum.
Right.
And at that point, I'd have to go to the sick room because I would genuinely feel sick, feel and get a stomach ache and just feel, you know, ill. So my abiding memory of being at that school for, in the end, a term, I was only there for a term, was of being in the sick room.
Yeah.
And they put me in there and I'd just kind of lie on this couch, and there'd be a clock, and I'd be looking at the clock, watching the seconds ticking away, and there was nothing to do, and I was bored, but I was also feeling sick and feeling terrified, and there was no one to talk to.
Horrible.
And it was just, and outside, of course, I'd hear people playing hockey, and I'd hear, you know, the bell going, and people walking down the corridors, and I'd just be sitting there thinking, what next? You know, like, what do I do now?
No.
So I think that
it becomes rather desperate, doesn't it? As well?
Really desperate. Yeah, it was awful because I didn't know the answer and nobody knew the answer. And the more I could see the anxiety in everybody's eyes, you know, my parents and the teachers and everybody sort of looking at each other like, well, what do we do? I don't know. How do we get around this? I don't know what we do now. The more I saw that, the more scared I got because I just thought, well, they're not in control either. So
at the age of 11, suddenly you had the fragility of life thrust in front of you and became incredibly aware of it.
Yeah. And trying to take control of it. I think that's what it was I was thinking, well, I'm nearly a grown up now. I'm about to go to secondary school. So I need to be able to control this.
Right.
This sort of random narrative that's happened in the space of a week where we've lost one member of the family and nearly lost another. And nobody seems to be in control here. Nobody seems to, you know, so it better be me because I'm nearly a grown up now. And it's obviously something's changed and it's probably my fault because that, of course, is what kids think. It's their fault or they're the ones who've got the answers. It was very, I mean, I look back on it now, I suppose, as you do when you get older and you've had a bit of therapy, I look back on it and I think, well, it was quite valuable, actually. It was all quite useful because it meant that I explored a lot of quite dark thoughts and thought processes very young.
Yes.
I went through, that was, in a way, that was sort of my teenage rebellion. I didn't have a teenage rebellion because I'd kind of done all that when I was 11. I'd gone through the, you're all idiots, you people who think you're adults, you don't know anything.
And what's the point anyway?
What's the point of all? I'd done all that when I was 11. So there was a value to it, undoubtedly. Yeah. You know, nothing is without value in life. And it certainly has informed my work, actually. It's informed my acting work. I think it gave me an early insight into thought processes and how everybody's thought processes have a kind of logic to them. However bizarre they appear from the outside, there's a kind of logic to it. And that, of course, as an actor, is immensely valuable.
Yes.
When you're playing someone who's behaving irrationally or indeed wickedly, you need to know that they don't see it as irrational and wicked.
No.
There's a perfect logic to them in what they're doing. So as far as, for me as an 11-year-old, thinking death was out to get my family and I was the only person who could protect us, that made perfect sense to me.
Yes.
There was nothing illogical about that at all. It's only when you look back on it and you think, oh, boy, you'd really gone to a dark place. You know.
So is that also fed into the idea of, because a lot of people find the idea of acting quite frightening, the idea of doing something in public, in front of people. I couldn't stand up there and do that.
Yeah.
That's what people say. So if you find yourself in that situation or find yourself in a situation that's frightening, are you able to delve back into that, being able to control it, being able to conquer it?
I think that's a really interesting question because to me the two things are unconnected in that sense. They're very connected in the sense that, as I just said, about understanding thought processes, but they're unconnected in that at the time I wasn't able to control the appearance of my anxiety, and now I am. But maybe that's the connection, is that at the time I couldn't and now I can.
Yes.
So now I can be very anxious and not show it. And when I was 11, I couldn't do that. Because if I was scared, I also thought it made sense. I thought it was logical to be scared. I couldn't understand why other people weren't scared as well.
No.
So there was
I had that experience in a pantomime. I'm always going back to pantomime, I'm afraid. It must be my life. But I did The Wizard of Oz, and I played the Scarecrow. And the pantomime starts, as many pantomimes do, with the witch appearing on stage in green light and a flash, great bang, and then she suddenly screeches and laughs manically. And she did this every performance, and some children would find it a bit frightening, but once one child leapt from their seat right at the front and ran down the aisle.
Oh.
And then halfway down, this child stopped and looked back at the audience, and in a pause on stage, this child went, "It's a witch!"
Oh!
So not only was the child terrified,
yes,
but it had the bravery to stop and try and save everyone else. Do you not realise, this is a witch? Run, for God's sake!
That's incredible!
So for a little child, that logic is completely sound.
Yeah, why can you not see this when I can see it?
What's wrong with you all?
Yeah, that's extraordinary.
Isn't it? Bless him.
From a cynical perspective, I bet the person who was playing the witch was delighted.
Oh, gotcha.
I am a witch.
Them in tonight. And I'm going to eat you.
Totally in character. I don't know how I did it that night, but I was in the zone.
Terrifying, darling. Terrifying. Maybe it was the cream makeup nose.
No, I don't think it was. I think it was something I was giving off.
It was in me.
The awful thing is, we both know that's how we would have thought. On the one hand, I thought, oh, that's terrible. I've
upset
a child.
Poor little child. God, I'm good.
God, I'm good. I've really got it. Still got it going on.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, yes.
That moment of sitting in that room, feeling ill, feeling terrified, it's a horrible thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you really want to take you as a little 11-year-old girl and just cuddle you and just say, oh, it's all right.
Okay.
It's not your fault.
Yeah, I think.
Which, of course, is what that the deputy headmistress did eventually.
Yeah, she did. Well, she did this brilliant thing where she, when I went for my interview at the next school, they'd already, they offered me a place, but they obviously kind of wanted to know what had gone on, why this person had gone to this school that everybody regarded as a better school and was suddenly sort of
and
refusing
failed
to go. And it was. So she and the head teacher kind of called me in and with my mum, and I was already in tears because I was already thinking I'm not going to be able to do this. And it all was very, it became very sort of heightened and very agitated. And in fact, there was a moment when I tried to run away and my mum opened the door of the headmistress's office and tried to drag me back in. And then the deputy head appeared and I apparently was seen kicking her because I was in a panic attack. You know? And they got me back into the head teacher's office. And they calmed me down a bit. But at that point, the head teacher said to me, sorry, the deputy head said, look, you know, let's just calm down for a minute here. What is it you're frightened of? And I said, I can't be without my mum. I can't leave my mum. And she just sort of very calmly said, OK, well, firstly, you don't have to. And secondly, why? Which people hadn't done before. Previously, no. People have been going, well, you can't come to school with that. You know, you can't
bring your mum with you.
You've just got to do this. It's what people do. Yeah. They go to school. And you just... And she just sort of went, OK, well, let's keep your mum here for a minute and we'll talk and we'll find out what do you think will happen. And she then came up with this brilliant solution where she said, because my mum used to write children's books, and she said to my mum, we've got a very good library here, you know. Mum said, yes, I know, because in fact, ironically, it was the school my mum had gone to as a child. And this teacher said, why don't you, maybe you could research one of your books in the library for a little while.
Brilliant.
And then she kind of looked across at me and just said, for as long as it took. I mean, you know, it could be a couple of weeks or it could be longer, if however long a book takes. And it
fantastic.
Was, she never at any point said, do you want your mum to be in school with you? She just kept up this thing of, that could be a thing then, couldn't it?
Mm.
So it saved face and it got my mum into the school, then it got me into lessons. And within, I think, about 3 days or something, I just said, yeah, I'm fine now. You're fine.
You can go home,
mum, you know. Yeah. But years afterwards, my brother Jeremy and I did a little drama about this for Sky. We were asked to do a sort of autobiographical drama, and I said I wanted to write about that. And I played the deputy head teacher. And I got in touch with her because we'd stayed in touch. We were always doing Christmas cards and things to each other. So I got in touch and I said, look, I'm doing this piece, and you'll notice when I'm talking about it, I haven't named her, because she actually said at the time she didn't want her name mentioned. So we gave her a false name. But she was very happy for me to write about it. And I said, look, while I've got you on the phone, what do you remember about all of that? And she was brilliant. She came up with all these lovely little details. Like she said, I remember a very frightened little girl with her shoes on the wrong feet. And I had no idea. I'd obviously done that thing of thinking,
yes,
if my shoes are on the wrong feet, I can't go to school, I suppose. Yes. But I don't remember.
Things have to be right.
Yeah.
For it to work.
But apparently I'd walked into school with my shoes on the wrong feet and she clocked it. And then I said, as a joke, I sort of said, one thing I do remember at the time, I remember a lot of the girls saying, we saw you kicking the deputy head teacher. And she said, yes, you did, dear. And I said, oh, my goodness, I'm so sorry. And she said, no, it was just a playful little kick. And of course it wasn't a play. You know, I was having a massive meltdown.
Yeah.
But she rationalised it as, that's OK, it's not personal. She's not a bad child. There's no such thing as a bad child. She's an upset child. It was incredible. She was just very forward thinking.
Mm.
And just a rather brilliant woman.
And
actually, as I'm talking to you, I've just popped into my head that on the dressing table behind there's a tiny little brown jewellery box, you can see.
Yes.
Which is from her, and it was the last thing she... Because we used to exchange cards and things every year. And when she knew she was very ill, she said, oh, I'm sending you something, dear. And this little parcel arrived, and it was this tiny... Apparently she had a collection of jewellery boxes, and she'd wanted me to... She was sending them to nieces and cousins, and she wanted me to have
them. Oh, fantastic.
So I always keep it there, and I just put
what an honour.
Earrings and things in it. But it's a tiny, tiny little thing that's just a memento of her, because she did. She put my life on the right track again. Mm. She changed everything. So even there, you see, it's not that negative a memory.
No,
but just those.
But that moment is
the sick room.
See, that's a desperate moment, isn't it?
Well, it's horrible because everybody was outside having fun.
Yeah.
And I think in that situation where, with any kind of mental, particularly mental illness, which it was at the time, it was an anxiety disorder, I suppose, or something. But I think you are acutely aware that, you know how people always say the worst thing you can say to someone who's depressed or anxious is, you know, pull yourself together. Come on, just get out of it. Because that's what you want more than anything. You're acutely aware that actually this is coming from you.
Yes.
That this is not cancer or arthritis or something that's landed on you. This is coming from within you, but that doesn't mean that you can just snap out of it. It doesn't mean you can just hand it over to somebody else.
No.
And I couldn't. I could no more snap out of it than
so
I could.
Don't be frightened of scared spiders. They're only tiny.
Yeah, exactly. You know? It just it doesn't... It That's not how it is to you. And that is immensely powerful. Mm. And I remember being in that sick room and just thinking, I could be out there running around with all my friends. Because I was, half an hour ago, I was fine, and then it just suddenly kicked in again, and I could be doing that, but I just didn't, I couldn't know how to make that transition. I couldn't just snap out of it and make it all okay again, because I was who I was for all those reasons at that time, and it was impossible for me to get through it. But I think the reason I sort of went public about it in the end was I was working with a mental health charity at the time to do with panic attacks and phobias and things like that. And I just suddenly thought, nobody seems to talk about kids having it. And I know loads of kids who've had panic attacks and anxiety. And it's very, very, very,
it very is very common. Yes.
Lots of kids who are school phobic. Lots
Once
of
you
kids
go into it, you find... No, I know. And many of them are just sitting at home. And they're a completely wasted group of people.
Absolutely. And it really... You know, we need to be more aware of it. And I think the more people who... You know, particularly people who are sporadically in the public eye and therefore clearly are sort of functioning, you know, doing okay for themselves. It's quite good, I think, to just then say, well, you know, when I was 11, everybody kind of was thinking, what the hell is going to happen now? Because I was on the verge of dropping out of school. I was on the verge of not doing any of the stuff that I've done because nobody knew what they were going to do with me. So I think it's important to say to people, it's okay, it's all right, there's a future in this. There is a future, you just can't see it at the moment.
No.
And that's all right, and you need to try not to be, you know, obsessing about that, because that's something else to worry about.
Particularly for those poor children who actually...
know you will be fine.
Yeah, those poor children who actually go to the point where they really see no future for themselves.
Yeah.
And that's an awful thing.
Absolutely, and again, is horribly common. So it's really, really important, I think, if you can, to sort of go, it's okay, just take a step back here, because no one's asking you to snap out of it, but just do be aware you will not always be like this. It will get better.
Yes. So let's take your poor little 11-year-old self sitting in the sick room with a ticking clock.
I know.
Oh,
horrible.
Oh, no, I can't. Oh, it's so awful to
it's
picture
horrid,
it.
It's horrid, isn't it?
Yes. All right, let's lock it in the time capsule.
Yes, send it away. We never think about that again.
Gone.
And let's go for a nice positive one.
Yes, come on, your final item.
So positive one would really be right up to date, and it involves you, actually, and your lovely family. In that you've been to this house many, many times,
yes.
I know, for Phil's famous Sunday lunches and pre-Christmas lunches and things. So Phil, my husband, is a fantastic cook and an incredibly keen cook and host. He loves it. He's not someone who kind of has to show off his cooking and therefore obsesses about it and gets stressed. He just loves having people around a kitchen table, having a drink and eating food that he's prepared and having a good time. He absolutely lives for it. This
yes,
is his
I've seen him cater for great
force.
Crowds of people so easily.
25 people.
Whilst having conversations with everybody and drinking wine and being so
it's
easy.
It's an extraordinary thing that he can do and I can't do. And it amused him hugely when I told him that I was going to put one of Phil's Sunday lunches into the time capsule, because he knows that I give him such a hard time about it. Because every time we do it, I say to him, first of all, oh, God, really? I haven't got the energy. You know, I'll have been working the week before. I just really... Then I complain that he's inviting too many people, because he can't just invite... You know, to me, just get two people round and we'll have a nice quiet lunch. But no, it's ends up being... Well, I've got another few couples and their kids are in town, so we've got... You know, so it's only 15. I don't know what the problem is.
Oh, the audience of the show, I saw.
Yeah, and the people from the shop round the corner, and they bring you a few animals.
And he does that brilliant thing of never being embarrassed to put people together who don't know each other.
No, in fact, he insists on it. Which is another thing I have a go at him about, because I think that's slightly rude to do that, to sort of tell people where they have to sit. I think it's...
It takes
so
a
basically,
bit,
I have a go
at
him about everything. I say, it's too much food, you spent too much money, what did you have to buy wild salmon for? That's ridiculously expensive. We could have fed a village in, you know, Lord knows where on that. It's a stupid thing to do. What did you do that for? Profligate. I go on about just everything. I have a go at him about everything. It's all too much effort. And the reality is I do nothing. Literally, I turn up you know, I kind of broadly make sure that the loos look clean because
brush
I'm
your hair.
Suburban. Brush my hair if you're lucky.
If you're lucky.
Turn up, have a lovely time and enjoy it. And then he usually does most of the clearing up. I do a bit of it because I feel guilty, but he does pretty well everything and I still moan at him about it. So this is sort of by way of an apology to Phil that I'm putting this in, because actually the truth is that those Sunday lunches are a crucial part of our lives as a family and as a sort of social group, a social network, for want of a better phrase. I think it's helped our kids to become the people that they are because they've been surrounded by a mismatched group of people, you know, almost every Sunday throughout their childhood. They've been expected to, you know, join in and behave and get on with people and tell stories and laugh at other people's stories.
And they do. They don't do that thing of just going off and playing on the iPad.
No, I mean, they do. They will. When they were younger, they would, you know, most of the kids would peel off after lunch and they'd go and sit and
watch a video or something.
But they'd, but no, they were, you know, both kids will ask questions and they'll listen and enjoy people's stories. And it's meant, I think, that as they've got older, they're much more socialized than I think I probably was at that age. They can kind of mix with anybody and fit in with anybody, and I think they kind of enjoy it. Certainly Ollie is very sociable and really loves it. I think Tilly's probably slightly more like me and would quite like to just sit and watch an old film in front of a fire and not have to be doing with it. She gets a huge amount out of it, I think, and I certainly do, because it just means our kitchen is kind of a hub of interesting, fun people of all ages. And that's really important as well, that it's not just people of our age.
No.
We'll have sort of people in their 90s and people in their teens, and yes, everybody sits together and everybody, you know, mucks in and helps clear the table. And it's all very sociable and very, very, very informal.
My memories of them are always the conversations I've had with the children.
Yeah, and you are brilliant, absolutely. I mean, kind of uniquely brilliant with kids.
Well, I think that's because I always try to talk to them. Well, I always assume, in fact, that they're probably more intelligent than me.
That's brilliant, yes. And almost certainly true, because kids are ferociously wise and intelligent.
And they will see the world in a way that is much clearer than your sort of befuddled, so-called educated idea of the world. I remember my son, as a very young boy, just finding him sitting in the living room, coming in and realising that he'd watched the 6 o'clock news and was very upset by it. And I said, are you all right? What's the matter? And he said, they killed someone. And I said, who did? They said, in America, they killed him. And I realised that there'd been a report about a man who'd been on death row being executed.
Yeah. And he was horrified.
He just could not understand it.
Yeah.
What gives you the right to do that?
Yeah. How is that making a good lesson of, you know, it's a terrible thing to kill someone, so we're going to kill someone to prove to you how terrible.
Yes.
Yeah. I may have told you this, but we had a wonderful moment when Tilly was tiny. She was probably about 3. And we were watching a news report about that Boxing Day tsunami, which was, you know, so devastating. And it was all over the news. And she came into the room and the whole family was sitting watching this. And she said, what's wrong? And we said, oh, sweetie, there's been this awful thing that's happened. There's been a flood. And she said, well, and I said, well, it's a long way from here, honey. It was, you know, but I'm afraid it's lots of people have, you know, died, or, and it's very bad. And she said, where again? And I said, it was in Thailand. And she went, oh, Thailand. I hope so. Noddy is okay.
Oh, no.
And it was a sort of beautiful moment. On the one hand, we were all feeling devastated by what had actually happened. And on the other hand, it was a wonderful moment of,
Thailand.
Oh, no, it's okay. It's all right. Don't worry. It wasn't Noddy.
Oh, no.
I hope so. Noddy is okay.
Oh,
I love the syntax as well.
Yeah.
It was just so perfect.
Perfect.
One of the things you're famous for in my family is that when Ollie was about... Ollie was a very late walker. He didn't walk till he was about, I don't know, 15, 16 months old or something, which is, from what I remember, quite late for a baby. And he crawled super fast, so he didn't really need to. But gradually we managed to get him on his feet and he managed to start toddling. And then Phil went away on a business trip and I got offered a radio job down on which we were going to record on a farm in Worcestershire. And you were there.
Yes.
But I only took it because I knew you were there. And I thought, OK, well, if Mike's there, he'll help me look after Ollie and that'll be fine. So you travelled down with me, I remember.
Yes.
And looked after Ollie in the car while I was driving. And then when I was doing scenes, you and indeed most of the other actors would take it in turns to entertain Ollie. And that was great. Mm. And Ollie, as I say, had just learnt to walk, so he was just sort of, you know, doing his little sort of toddling about, and everybody was quite enchanted by that, and it's great. And then we drove home again, and Phil came back from his business trip, and the next day, the first day he was back, Phil said, what's happened to Ollie's walking? And I said, oh, he's still walking. And he said, no, look, he's doing this weird walk. And you taught him to to walk like a gorilla or something. So he just learnt to walk. He'd finally learnt to walk, Mike.
And
you taught him this thing where his arms were sort of, it was like kind of Mr. Gumby from Monty Python. His arms were stretched out straight. And he was kind of leaning forward and jutting his jaw out and doing this brilliant, hilarious, but absolutely not appropriate walk.
No. We're going to put him in nursery, not
and
now.
And it was all down to you. And yes, I remember just watching him walk across the room and then looking at Phil and just going, it'll be Mike. I just knew it was you.
Yeah. Yes, I've done that with too many people's children. I just think that actually, if it's fun, then it can't be wrong.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and it wasn't. He's fine now. I mean, he's at university now. He does still walk.
Walk like a gorilla. It's fantastic.
But they love it there. It's a conversation piece.
He became an anthropologist.
Yes. And it's all down to you. Anyway, so Sunday lunch, big Sunday lunches, lots of noisy conversation, lots of actors' anecdotes.
Your husband in his apron at the stove.
His apron, yeah. And me doing virtually nothing, just sitting there and, you know, having a glass of champagne and smiling at everybody and enabling the odd anecdote. But yeah, I do, don't tell Phil that, don't ever let Phil listen to this.
No.
I do actually now love it, really love it, and think it's a kind of crucial linchpin of our family life. So.
Well, I don't blame you. I've always loved it.
Oh, well, that's good to know. We can tell him that bit.
Yeah.
Just not the bit about me enjoying it.
Oh, fantastic. So, Rebecca, thank you so much
for letting me
into your bedroom. What should we do now?
I don't know. I mean, we've got this big bed. I can't think what we could do.
Okay, I'm going to stop the recording now.
Restoration comedy now.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Michael Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Rebecca Front. This program was produced and edited by John Fenton-Stevens, and the music was by Past the Peas Music. If you've enjoyed this podcast, then please subscribe to it on the Acast player or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow us and find behind-the-scenes photos and extra content on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at MyTCPod. Or you can follow me on Twitter at Fenton Stevens. My Time Capsule is a cast-off production. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join me again next time. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.